Well, history is littered with famous political comebacks. De Gaulle, Churchill, Nixon, Japan's Prime Minister Abe, they all come to mind. So too do Australian Prime Ministers, Menzies, Howard, even Rudd and Turnbull. All were written off, their political obituaries had been written, yet they bounced back with tremendous force. Could we put Tony Blair in their camp? He recently announced his return to frontline politics in Britain after being more or less in the political wilderness for the past decade. To talk more about Blair, the British election, and of all people, Donald Trump and his tweets, let's hear from one of old Blighty's leading political commentators. Peter Oborn is a columnist with the Daily Mail, and he's just co-written How Trump Thinks, His Tweets, and the Birth of a New Political Language. Peter, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Tony Blair has said that last year's vote for Brexit has given him the impetus to get involved in politics again. He's ready to get his hands dirty and that he was willing to come back even if he gets a, quote, bucket of what's it thrown over him. Peter, how many people have their buckets ready?
I'd say quite a few. I mean, of course, if Mr. Blair wants to come back, he can do. I do think that there are an awful lot of questions he still hasn't really dealt with, above all the Iraq war and the aftermath of the devastating Chilcot inquiry into the war, which found incredible incompetence and probably, although Chilcot didn't say it, deception at the heart of the Blair machine in the run-up to war. And Blair has to cope with that, that he's played a major role in bringing about the most disastrous conflict in recent memory.
Yes, you wrote a column, I think, saying how I long to see Blair in the dock being called to account for Iraq. That was one of your headlines for a Daily Mail column.
Yeah, and so he will have to cope with that. Now, not everybody agrees. Rupert Murdoch, who I believe is neither British nor Australian, but in fact American these days, he seems to be a terrific supporter of Mr. Blair, and he has very powerful newspapers.
So, but didn't they have a falling out a few years ago over Rupert Murdoch's ex-wife, Wendy Deng?
Yes, I'd forgotten that thing, but which you allude to. But you know, he has a general view that the Iraq war was a great thing.
But on the decision to invade Iraq, Peter, I mean, you and I have talked about this in the past, but Blair was hardly alone. I mean, why is it that Blair keeps getting subjected to all this intense criticism, whereas the other collaborators, most notably George Bush and Australia's John Howard, largely escape censure?
It's a very interesting question. I think it's because Mr. Blair was on the left. Howard, who was a very distinguished Prime Minister of Australia, and Bush were on the right. Therefore, they were expected to do terrible things. That's what right-wing politicians do. Left-wing liberal politicians are expected to do good things. And the people who hate Blair in Britain are, on the whole, the liberal left. The right, quite a lot of the right, likes and admires Mr. Blair. In Britain, where the left has a powerful role in the media, it means that you do get, you run up against a lot of opposition and grief if you are somebody like Mr. Blair.
Yeah.
George Bush, you know, is a cuddly old bastard.
I was going to say, sorry for interrupting you, but John Major once said of Tony Blair that he was a Tory at heart and, quote, in many ways, he was to the right of me. I remember joking once that I had gone swimming in the River Thames and left my clothes on the bank, and when I got back, Mr. Blair was wearing them.
Yes, well, that's, of course, a very ancient political strategy, stealing your opponent's clothes. And Tony Blair, because he came over as so beautifully middle class, was ideally placed to carry out that act of larceny against the Conservative Party of John Major.
And of course, Major and Blair are in cahoots against you Brexiteers, right?
That is true. I mean, Major is less obvious, but it is the case that what you might call the old British establishment is trying to galvanise a new centrist party of some kind. And that's a process which will stretch beyond this current general election.
Well, that brings us to this election. I mean, it was about 20 years ago when Blair notched up the biggest post-war election victory for any party. And yet here we are in 2017, Peter. Labor appears to be heading for the worst performance of any opposition in decades. How do you account for the dire state of the British Labor Party?
Yeah, I mean, not just decades. I mean, it could be the worst performance, I think, since 1935. That's 80 years ago. I can see Labour collapsing to around 100 seats, actually, from the current 230 or so. I think there are several reasons, the most acute of which is Brexit, because Labour was pro-European Union, but a very substantial number of its voters, working class voters, were opposed to the European Union. They were the ones who suffered most acutely from mass immigration, which Tony Blair had ushered in at the turn of the century, and their livelihoods, the pressure on public services, the fat cats Mr. Blair liked. They benefited from cheaper domestic labour and cheaper wages all round in the case of capitalists, whereas the working folk saw the nature of, in many cases, the nature of their communities change very fast and saw their own livelihoods come under pressure. And so they weren't represented by Labour in Brexit and have gone off to other places. First of all, to the United Kingdom Independence Party in many cases, and now in this general election, onwards to the Tories. Everything's being blamed on Jeremy Corbyn, who's a rather engaging old left-wing rascal. But actually, I think there are more fundamental reasons.
Yes, but to be fair, though, Peter, I mean, if you read The Guardian or watch the BBC, as many Australians and presumably many of our listeners do, one gets the impression that Britain right now is having some post-Brexit anxiety, even buyer's remorse about leaving the European Union. Is that how you read things?
I don't think that's happening. The polls I've seen suggest, if anything, the reverse, that more people support Brexit than before. You have to accept that the BBC is institutionally pro-European, and The Guardian is a pro-European paper. So, and the Financial Times, they all project a particular point of view. It isn't a widespread feeling. You'd be wrong to extrapolate from listening to the BBC a Brexit remorse in Britain at this moment. It may come later. Who knows?
My guest is Peter Oborne. He's one of Britain's leading columnists and broadcasters, formerly with The Spectator, The Telegraph, and these days with The Daily Mail. He's just co-authored a book called How Trump Thinks, His Tweets and the Birth of a New Political Language, just out. Speaking of Trump and your book on his tweets, Peter, you're one of the most distinguished and influential commentators in Westminster. Why on earth did you write a book on Trump's tweets?
Well, Trump's tweets are a completely new phenomenon. If you're interested in politics, you have to be interested in the creation by the presidential candidate, as he then was, of a new form of political discourse, of a new political language. And Trump's tweets were exactly that. He found a new way of talking to the United States people. It's 140 characters. It's barbaric. It's brutal, often wickedly funny. I couldn't resist trying to explain what happened. He himself says that his tweets won him the presidential election last year.
Yeah, the start of your book begins with a quote from Trump. I think that maybe I wouldn't be here in the White House if it wasn't for Twitter.
Yes, it's very interesting. If you look back in history, the emergence of US presidents or even British prime ministers often coincides with a new form of communication. One thinks of President Roosevelt and his fireside chats, his radio chats to the American people in their front room. JF Kennedy, and he was the first to master TV and use it. Now with the new social media, bizarrely, against anything anybody would expect, the person who has mastered it was not Hillary Clinton with all of those bright young Democratic whiz kids around her, but in fact it was this kind of old businessman, Trump, and he was wickedly funny. I mean, they're awful, they're appalling in many ways, they're vulgar, but there is something freewheeling and exciting about them, particularly the fact that he appears to put out the best of them himself.
Yes. Well, your argument also is that Trump, by using Twitter, has helped repudiate, humiliate, destroy the so-called experts and the cultural gatekeepers of the elite public discourse. That's your argument. So as a result, here's Trump, in a bizarre way, giving politics to the people who vote.
Yeah. Dashiell Hammett, who said it about Dashiell Hammett, that he gave murder back to the people who commit it? He's a crime writer in the 30s.
Yes.
And Trump gave politics back to the people who vote. And he did it using Twitter to find a way around. As you, I like that phrase, cultural gatekeepers, the CNN, the Washington, the New York Times, etc. And him to engage very directly with his voters. And all the niceties, the sophistication, the liberal values, which all of those organizations represented, he was able to veer past them. I was surprised to find myself getting quite frightened by Trump as I studied his tweets. They are he is a nasty piece of work.
Well, I mean, I think you've called him a bigot, a braggart, a bully, a racist, a misogynist. We could go on. But, you know, I've read your book. I think it's very good, Peter. But I have to say I was a bit perplexed because Trump is a teetotaler, doesn't drink alcohol. So, Peter, I'm still left wondering, how do you account for this, that a sober man sends angry, hilarious, in unintended ways, tweets in the middle of the night?
Yeah, well, they've got to remember this. This is the first rule, Oborne's first rule of politics. The more a politician drinks, the better judgment he has, and vice versa.
Right.
So you have the great notorious teetotalers of political history, led by one Adolf Hitler.
He didn't drink, yeah.
Yeah. George W. Bush. Not that he was a blunderer and a bad man, I think.
Well, I think with Bush, would he have invaded Iraq if he enjoyed a drink? That's your line.
Exactly. Whereas Winston Churchill, he started drinking at breakfast time. And so, you know, World War II, which was the ultimate conflict between good and evil, you know, on the one side we're led by a boozer, on the other side by a teetotaler. I rest my case. And Trump is, unfortunately, doesn't drink, and he does it and goes a long way. You see, if you drink, you can calm down a bit. You know, just a way of relaxing and seeing life through a set of mellow glasses and realizing that, you know, everything doesn't matter that much.
Indeed. No. Despite all his flaws, though, you have written in the Daily Mail in your regular column that his election last November, Peter, quote, marks a rare moment of convulsive change in world history. And your point was that whereas revolutions, apart from military coups, usually come from the left, here we have a case where Trump's rise, rather like Brexit, comes from the right.
This is the central story of our times. When you and I, I'm older than you, but we're at school, we thought that revolutions came from the left. That's what they were. They were sort of part of the definition. That all dates back to the French Revolution, and it was always getting rid of backward conservative forces. What has happened, not just in the United States, but in Britain and across Europe too, is the forces of radical and revolutionary change are from the right now. And that is because, I think it's because these are deep waters. There was the left won the battles of the post-war political battles as a whole, but certainly the cultural battles. And the left secured, and it won the institutions, the BBC, it won the universities, it won the war of ideas, and it formed an alliance through, if you look at figures like Blair, like probably Macron, it formed an alliance with the neoliberal right. Hillary Clinton's a fascinating case of that. And it did so by disenfranchising millions and millions of voters who had nowhere to go because they'd been abandoned by their traditional left-wing parties. And what we've seen is a series of rebellions against the new establishment over the last 2 years. That's what we're living through. None of us really expected is the right as a force of revolutionary change. Now, that isn't, even though I'm on the right, it isn't something which makes me completely comfortable at all. Because it unleashes dangerous forces.
Peter, we could keep going about this, but thank you so much for being on ABC Radio again this morning, and all the best with the book.
Thank you very much indeed, Tom.
That was Peter Oborne from the Daily Mail in London. He's co-author of How Trump Thinks, His Tweets, and The Birth of a New Political Language, just out this week. You're on RN Sunday Extra.